Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Data Sets on the Current and Future Management of Small Cell Lung Cancer. This is actually the fourth webinar we did in relation to the World Conference on Lung Cancer that was recently held. And today we're going to talk a little bit about small cell with Dr. Jacob Sands from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Dr. Sands is actually in Korea giving a talk to the Korean Medical Society, so we're happy to have him there. I'm sure they're happy to have you there as well. As we do in all our programs, we will be talking about non-FDA-approved uses of agents and regimens, so check out package inserts for more information. So here's where we're heading. Mainly, we want to talk about new papers and new data sets that have been presented in small cell, where things are heading in this disease. But we're going to start out as a way of introduction and maybe kind of bringing us up to date on where we are today in terms of treatment of small cell by looking at a case scenario that Dr. Sands made up for us. It really gets into a number of key issues that he wanted to make. Jacob, you put together a 66-year-old man who gets a lung cancer screening. I'm curious why you built that into the case, incidentally. Is that one of your passions?
Yeah, lung cancer screening is our greatest opportunity at impacting cancer mortality. Despite really being our greatest opportunity and our opportunity to cure as much cancer as possible, it's only being done in really around 15% of people who qualify. So it's extremely important, and it's a way of diagnosing earlier stage so we can then treat with goal of cure.
Can I just sort of add a slight note of skepticism to that? I don't know. There's something about screening for lung cancer that seems counterintuitive to me. I mean, I imagine other people as well. You guys seem to have the data, but it's somehow kind of challenging to buy into. You think any myths or misperceptions that you see about lung cancer screening?
Well, I think there are a lot, and I don't think you're alone. And that's part of our effort is making sure people understand the data on that. We have the NLST, which was a more than 53,000 individual study. They got a CAT scan. Half of them got a CAT scan once a year for 3 years. Half of them got a chest x-ray once a year for 3 years, with then about 9 years of follow-up. We saw an all-cause mortality benefit in the group that got CT scan, 6.7%. We saw a lung cancer-specific mortality benefit of 20%. But we also saw a huge stage shift from screen-detected lung cancers being about 70% stage 1-2 in that group that was randomized to CAT scans. In those follow-up years where they were no longer getting those CT scans, when they're diagnosed with a lung cancer, it was the majority were stage 4. And so it also highlights that, people need, if they're getting screening, they need to keep getting it every year.
What about for small cell, when you do screening, do you see a downstaging compared to people who walk in off the street? I would assume so. You built this case to have limited stage disease. Is that more common?
Yeah, it is, but not like non-small cell lung cancer. In a lung screening program, especially when people are past that baseline year where they can have more late stage disease, they haven't been getting screened. In the following years, it could be around 85% stage 1 non-small cell lung cancer. But in small cell lung cancer, it really is only about 50% limited stage. Just small cell progresses so rapidly, it's not as effectively screened.
So again, building on recent literature, you made this case an Adriatic case of limited stage disease. And you were telling me before we got started, you actually haven't treated a patient with the Adriatic regimen. I'm curious what your take is on what to expect. Obviously we have a lot of history in non-small cell giving chemo radiation with durvalumab. Now this is small cell. What do we know from the literature already? And what are you expecting when you start using this approach?
That's right. So I'm starting my first patient now on durvalumab post-chemo radiation based upon the Adriatic data. We enrolled to the atezolizumab trial, that the NRG study that included atezo with chemo radiation and then following for another year. And the experience with that was very good. At this point, we have so much experience with these PD-L1 inhibitors. I've fully expected these studies to be positive. It's taken a couple more years than I expected as well, so it was very nice to see that Adriatic data come out.
What are your thoughts about prophylactic cranial radiation at this point? I know, again, you built this case where the man chose to just have MR screening. Is that what you're generally doing?
You know, in limited stage, there's more variability, I think. In limited stage, I think a lot of people still hold on to that this is our opportunity for cure, and so patients should get prophylactic cranial irradiation. I am still a bit skeptical of that even. Now, not everybody is anymore, based upon the data that we saw years ago at this point from Japan with extensive stage, where Q3-month MRI brain monitoring certainly did as well, if not even a touch better, in survival than those who got prophylactic cranial irradiation. That has led to, in the extensive stage setting, kind of a leaning away from PCI. In limited stage, we still don't really have data for this, but our prior studies that showed survival benefit from PCI, none of them included an MRI brain at baseline. So, you know, those results are not really entirely valid. Now, in the limited stage setting at this point, I think many are getting PCI, but some are not. And this really ends up being an individual discussion with each patient.
So quick question from the chat room, and I would encourage people attending, if you have any questions about taking care of people with small cell, I'll throw them in here. It's an interesting question from Venue, Jacob. Any data for adding PD-1 concurrent with radiation therapy? Of course, that wasn't done in the Pacific trial either, but has that been looked at? Any rationale to do that?
It wasn't done in the Adriatic trial, but that was 2 years of durvalumab after chemo radiation. But it was done in the NRG study, the LU-005, which was chemo radiation with atezolizumab. The atezolizumab was started at cycle 2 at the time of initiating radiation as well, and then continued for 1 year after radiation. Now, those results should be out very soon. I don't know if there's been a press release on that yet, but it is imminent.
So again, we're going to get to some of the new stuff in a second, but just to kind of touch base about things that have been out there for a while. So you built this scenario for the patient then to develop recurrent metastatic disease, liver mets confirmed with biopsy, and it just gives us an opportunity, or you an opportunity, to talk something you've written a lot about, which is the treatment of recurrent small cell, not just in this situation, and more commonly, I guess, people presenting with extensive stage disease. Can you talk about, in both of those scenarios, how you sort of think through second-line therapy?
Yeah, now, first of all, I did not specify his smoking history, but I did specify that he had lung screening, which does indicate that he has a substantial smoking history. And somebody without a smoking history, though, getting genomic testing is really important. I'm not going to dive too much more into that, but I have seen MET exon 14 skipping mutation. I have a patient right now with an EGFR mutant, but de novo small cell lung cancer. So someone without smoking history, that needs to be checked. Everything we're discussing is more classic small cell lung cancer. So based upon the Adriatic data, which we'll go into, this patient, I built in the case to get treated on the Adriatic regimen, which is now what I consider the standard of care going forward. 6 months in, I specified multiple sites because this then leads to next line systemic therapy. And if there were only a solitary brain met or even a few brain mets with no other sites of disease, particularly if that patient has not gotten PCI, I would have the brain treated. And then I would continue on the durvalumab in this case, or monitoring if that's what he was on. I do not start next line therapy for brain only recurrence. And I have had some patients that really have gone on for years without recurrence, with just getting the brain treated. I think with our new paradigm where some patients aren't getting PCI, that's a particularly important point. But in this case, multiple sites of disease, this now opens it up. This is becoming such an interesting discussion now in the second line setting. Do we give lurbinectedin? Do we give tarlatamab? Do we give irinotecan? That's my preference to topotecan, but many still use topotecan. All of those are within the supported within the NCCN guidelines. And then platinum etoposide retreatment is also within the guidelines. And I do not really use much platinum retreatment. I think when patients have had platinum sensitive disease, that represents cytotoxic sensitive disease. And so they're more likely to also have responses to these other cytotoxics. Now, in this case, 6 months after chemo radiation, to have progression at that point. I'm putting it right on the cusp. So you can really choose from all of these. And I think there are differences in people's practices as far as which they would choose. There are then also clinical trials options. And, you know, we'll discuss ifinatamab deruxtecan. That has shown an impressive response rate. I think there are some nuances to discuss from that. There are a number of other trials as well. I think it's an exciting time as far as treatment options in small cell lung cancer.
We got a lot of stuff coming in the chat room here. We've stoked a lot of people's thinking here. So let me throw a few things out before we go any farther. I didn't figure those were going to happen. So see, this is like a memory test. See if you can remember all these questions. So first of all, Hassan wants to know what about, Dilip wants to know about CNS toxicity of PCI and risk factors for that. Where did I see the other one here? Oh, Swati, you commented a little bit on this. Can you talk a little bit more about rechallenge of platinum and when you'll rechallenge as opposed to not? Hassan wants to know about PARP inhibitors in small cell.
Okay, great. So starting out with PCI, you know, what I said is that now we're leaning away from it in extensive stage disease based upon what we've seen from that study out of Japan that showed no real difference when patients are getting MRI brain at baseline before randomization. The group that got every 3-month MRI brain did just as well, if not a touch better, than the group that got PCI. So in the extensive stage, we've leaned away from doing it, I think, for the majority of cases. In the limited stage setting, is actually where I think the question is most relevant, is what are the toxicities? You know, the patients that are cured of their disease, that have decades longer to live, PCI has more of a risk than of longer-term memory issues or toxicities. And so this is the setting where I think getting more data is really more important. We have the MAVERICK trial, which is currently ongoing in the U.S. This is a randomization to PCI versus Q3-month observation in limited stage and extensive stage. And I'm hoping we'll get something out of that when that completes, but that's still ongoing accrual.
So Duru in the chat room says, quote, my patient got demented from PCI but was cured of limited stage small cell.
I have a case like that too. The worst case I ever saw was somebody that I had see 4 different neurologists in Boston. Ultimately ended up going to the neurologist that the neurologists refer to. And unfortunately, in the end, it really seemed like it was from the radiation. There was nothing else that we could find. And this lady really became completely debilitated, but never, she didn't have small cell lung cancer. So I do worry about that. Now, fortunately, those are outlier cases to be so severe, but they concern me.
So, Emily is another person. A lot of people are putting stuff in here in the chat room about CNS issues with PCI. She says her patient had a metallic taste. Have you seen that?
Well, yes. And that, you know, we also see that sometimes after the platinum therapy as well. So, but I agree with all of this. I have concerns about toxicity. And this is why I say I think we're happy to lean away from using PCI, but then that changes the paradigm. You know, we're seeing more CNS occurrence in patients not getting PCI. And we know that from the studies we've seen that from that Japanese study I keep referring back to, in those that didn't get PCI, they were more likely to need radiation later. And so in someone who has limited stage disease that now has brain only recurrence, you need to consider that that wouldn't have shown up had they gotten PCI. So radiating it therapeutically and then monitoring is still in my practice. Now, to go back to the, you had listed a couple other questions, one being PARP inhibitor. You know, there are various studies with PARP inhibitors, and we can discuss that. There's not yet really a place for it that I see. We saw a SWOG trial in those with Schlafen-11 expression that has seemed to be a biomarker for increased likelihood of response to PARP inhibitors. That first line study with a PARP inhibitor and a SWOG trial, really the data on that didn't change practice. The curves don't separate that much. To me, it was a little disappointing to see that, particularly in a biomarker selected population. But it did show that we can do a biomarker driven trial, which I think was very encouraging.
So here's a slide with some of the targets that we're going to talk about today in small cell. I did a session a couple hours ago with Erica Hamilton from Sarah Cannon, and I was telling her that I saw a paper in your CV of a trispecific.
Yeah.
I never heard of trispecific. Yeah. CD3 trispecific. I love it.
That's right. That's right. So the HPN328, you see that there listed for DLL3. That's also tarlatamab, now an FDA-approved DLL3 CD3 bispecific. HPN328 is now MK6070. That's trispecific. It's DLL3, CD3, just like tarlatamab, and then also albumin. So this is a stabilizer, essentially.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the new stuff that's coming out in small cell. And as you alluded to, I mean, this ASCO was a great ASCO for lung cancer, particularly the plenary session. And one of the papers here was the Adriatic study, as we've been talking about, that then got published in the New England Journal. Anything you want to say about this? You were trying to bring up to me the issue of a question people come up with, why the survival was so, the median survival was so dramatic, and you put together a bunch of curves trying to explain it. You want to try to explain it to the audience?
Yeah. So, you know, people have seen Pacific worked well in non-small cell lung cancer. This was durvalumab after chemo radiation for non-small cell. We've seen the Caspian trial, first line for extensive stage small cell. It is a standard of care. Median overall survival difference in that study was about 2.5 months. So now to see something with a median overall survival difference of 22.5 months, this is a shocking number, a 22.5 month improvement in median overall survival with Adriatic. But the point is going to be the shape of the curves. Actually, the shape of the curves matches what we see in Caspian. We're just seeing it at that 50% mark on the on the axis there. So we're seeing those curves separate out at the point where the median really is, which is why we're seeing that wide median overall survival difference. But you'll see the separation of the curves is actually similar. In the progression-free survival curves of Adriatic, there was a median progression-free survival difference of about 7.5 months. Whereas in Caspian, it was actually very similar. There was no real difference in the median progression-free survival on Caspian. But the curves separate out similarly. And the really encouraging thing is that we see a tail of the curve on Adriatic that looks like longer-term disease control. And I think ultimately higher cure rates is what I expect with the incorporation of durvalumab after chemo radiation.
I mean, I don't know how, you know, accurate this figure is, but 12% five-year survival for extensive stage small cell, if that really is true, sounds kind of impressive.
Yeah, so this is the EMPOWER 133 follow-up. So this is extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Now, the EMPOWER 133 trial, they essentially closed the trial, but they wanted to continue the treatment on the patients that were getting atezolizumab. Now, unfortunately, you know, they named then the extension of those patients, Umbrella A. So it sounds like a different trial, but this is the extension of EMPOWER 133. So the patients that were still getting treatment with atezolizumab on EMPOWER 133 were then continued. And that cohort you see here in the swimmer's plot. So you can see there are people alive many years out. And I'll say I have patients more than 5 years out on atezolizumab, but all of the checkpoint inhibitors in that setting. I had a patient from the Pembro trial in the first line setting. You know, that was a negative trial, but a patient who was multiple years out without any evidence of recurrence or progression, I should say, because she had metastatic disease. She unfortunately died of a stroke, but never had, you know, but had disease control for about 5 years before she then had a stroke and off of treatment.
So we did a webinar last night on mantle cell lymphoma, and I was telling the faculty that we were going to be talking about a CD3 bispecific and a solid tumor. I think this is the first one that we had to deal with. And I was like, it has to be small cell. And so you can imagine how much we've talked about cytokine release syndrome in our myeloma and lymphoma programs. And we're like, whoa, is this going to be now for small cell? So let's talk a little bit about tarlatamab. This is your baby, so to speak. First of all, before we even get started, to what degree do you see cytokine release, and how much of a problem is it in these patients?
So it's about 50% of patients that have cytokine release syndrome, the majority of those being grade one, meaning they have a fever, they get some Tylenol, and that's it. But about 20% were grade two, 20% overall. So 50%, so 30% grade one, 20% grade two, essentially. And grade two is needing some oxygen for hypoxia or needing some IV fluids for hypotension. So, you know, that's really having some symptoms that requires real medical management. And in those settings, they get steroids. And for tarlatamab, what we saw is that was almost all of it. There was one case in the 10 milligram cohort. And this is the dosing that's FDA approved and now standard of care. In the 10 milligram group, there was one case of a grade three. Now, that was not at my institution, but and I'm not entirely sure on the specifics around that, but that patient apparently had this grade three, and the patient and family decided they don't want any further treatment. They actually went on to comfort measures only. So I don't think their CRS was even managed, and that patient was placed on comfort measures only. So I'm not sure of the specifics of that case, but it's certainly an unusual one. Now, the experience with this class of drugs, because of course we've accrued to more than just the tarlatamab trial, has been very good, and CRS cases have been quite manageable, respond really well to steroids when needed, and if they're having any real symptoms, then tocilizumab. If that grade two is escalating, tocilizumab is quite effective. But with tarlatamab, you see 40% response rate, another 30% with stable disease. Now, you know, you don't know what to make of stable disease. It's hard to, you know, it doesn't say in the chart whether those are sustained stable disease, but some of them are. And I think in small cell lung cancer, when we see stable disease, you know, that does represent some degree of benefit. There are some patients in that stable disease group that are benefiting because small cell tends to be a pretty rapidly progressive diagnosis. Here you see the median time to response was 1.4 months on tarlatamab, so basically around the first scan. The median duration of response, which was just reported out at World Lung, is 9.7 months. So really durable responses for small cell lung cancer. 43% of patients still ongoing treatment at the time of data cut. Right here, I think this chart is actually one of the most impressive to me. And this represents a new paradigm in small cell lung cancer therapy. When we see that the progression-free survival on first-line regimen, you can see whether the patients had less than or more than 90-day chemotherapy-free interval. It is not impacting their overall survival curves on tarlatamab. Now, in this trial, the majority of patients were getting this in the third line, but that platinum-resistant or platinum-sensitive disease, you know, that is an important indicator of the likelihood of cytotoxic responses. So all the other treatments that we're utilizing for these patients, we would see substantial separation of the curves there. But tarlatamab has a different mechanism. It's an immunotherapy. And so platinum sensitivity is not an indicator for the likelihood of response or the durability of response. Here's getting to your question on CRS. On the left there, you see 53% of patients had CRS. Outside of CRS, it was generally really well tolerated. I'll highlight the dysgeusia, which is there, the second from the right. And as we get further out into treatment, you know, once CRS is essentially first cycle. After that, there's not any. ICANS, which we'll discuss in a moment, is something to watch for. But after that, it's dysgeusia is really the one thing. I think this is a really helpful chart. So on the left there, you see CRS. So as I mentioned, 32% grade one, 20% grade two. There's that one outlier case that I highlighted for overall incidence of CRS on the left. Just to the right of that is recurrence. So anyone who had CRS, how many of them had another episode of CRS? You see 21% had a grade one as a recurrence and 4% grade two. And just to the right of that, you can see that this was almost all in cycle one. Now, cycle one is a day one and day eight infusion. The two of those infusions are generally happening inpatient at this point as standard of care. The FDA approval recommends 22 to 24 hour observation after infusion. The cycle two and beyond, cycle one is day one, day eight, and then day 15 as an outpatient. Cycle two is an every other week dosing. And there were only three instances of CRS in that. All three of those cases were patients that had a delay So they had a dose held for some reason or another, but there was a gap before then they were reinitiating tarlatamab. And when reinitiating tarlatamab, that's when there is some risk of CRS happening again. So all of those cases were that. So generally, if you treat someone through cycle one and they do okay, or they have CRS and then, you know, they recover, then going on, that's not really much of a concern. It really is just the very beginning. ICANS is a little bit different. This requires mental status testing. But, you know, that's really within the first 3 to 6 months that you see that. And there are four questions to ask people to do an ICE score. And so that's something for people to be aware of. A group of us have put together a toxicity management manuscript that has just been submitted and hopefully will be accepted and will be out there soon, because I think that'll be really helpful to people as they're treating on this standard of care.
Priya in the chat room wants to know, do you need to use infection prophylaxis?
But no. Like, you know, they don't need to go on Bactrim or anything like that.
Great. So speaking, you know, the recurrent setting with small cells has been a little discouraging, you know, in the recent years. We had LRRB to talk about, which I never could get too excited about. But now it looks like we got some hot stuff coming in here, not only tarlatamab, antibody drug conjugates, you know, all throughout oncology. Let's talk a little bit about IDXD, infinatumab, deruxtecan. What do we know about this agent? Obviously, we have a number of agents with the payload of deruxtecan, and particularly TDXD in HER2 disease. What about IDXD?
That's right. We have trastuzumab deruxtecan is FDA approved in HER2 positive breast and lung cancer. Datopotamab deruxtecan is the TROP2 ADC, patritumab deruxtecan, the HER3 ADC, and now ifinatamab deruxtecan, the B7H3 ADC, all of these with a deruxtecan payload. And I highlight that because there are some toxicities that are from that deruxtecan payload, which we'll discuss a little bit. But essentially, B7H3 is the antigen that the antibody binds to and then goes into the cell and releases the deruxtecan payload. And we've seen some impressive results. This is the IDeate Lung01 study. So this was two different dose levels, the 8 milligram per kilogram and the 12 milligram per kilogram dose levels. From the waterfall plots there, you see the majority of patients having some degree of tumor shrinkage, even more so in the 12 milligram per kilogram dose level. I think the PFS and OS curves look fairly similar, but the median certainly favors the 12 milligram per kilogram dose level. But the response rate of 55% in the 12 milligram per kilogram dose level, and that's a shockingly good response rate for small cell lung cancer in this line of therapy. Disease control rate of 90%, 80% at the 8 milligram per kilogram dose level. It's very good.
Sounds exciting. And then there's always the downside to consider. What do we know about IDXD? You know, with TDXD, we think about acute chemo-like side effects. I'm curious if you see that here. And obviously, the issue of interstitial lung disease. So what do we know about IDXD?
Yeah, we certainly see cytopenias. There's also, especially in that 12 milligram per kilogram dose level, that level of nausea that's there. Now, it's overwhelmingly grade 1-2. But, you know, I think we have to be careful not to just write off grade 1-2. Now, generally speaking, this can be for a couple of days after the infusions. So when you're getting long-term disease control and some nausea that can be managed with medications, you know, that also shouldn't be a detriment either. You mentioned the ILD. I don't think it's... at the very bottom, we see that. So the ILD, I think in the 12 milligram per kilogram dose level, it was just grade 1, 2, 3. But we do see some of those cases. There were 5 total. In the 8 milligram per kilogram cohort, it was 4 cases of ILD. Now, ILD is something we see across all of those deruxtecan studies. So the 4 different ones that I've mentioned, we see cases of ILD. I will highlight that across all of those studies, we see great variation between what the investigator grades the ILD and what the adjudication committee grades the ILD. We see real variation. And that just is to highlight that clinically, this is something that can be difficult to determine. And so I'd encourage anybody who's treating someone with one of these drugs, is you need to look for ILD. Certainly it's something we see across them. But when you see a case that you suspect is ILD, I highly encourage you to look for everything else. Because a drug-related ILD, can be, it's difficult to know whether there's something else going on. And you can lose the opportunity to do a bronchoscopy if you're waiting until symptoms get really so much worse. So it's important to consider all other options. I've had some cases where we did autopsy, and actually it looked more like a cancer progression and not as much an ILD. And so it's hard to know.
Do you think about, or do you actually use preemptive screening in a breast cancer? They're very aggressive about pulmonary screening. You're already looking at the lungs all the time anyhow, but they go out of their way to make sure these patients have CAT scans at least every 8 to 12 weeks for a long time, as long as the patient's on treatment. Are you thinking that's kind of the strategy you're going to do with these other agents?
Well, so that'll become particularly relevant in like earlier stage setting. And for this drug, even for IDXD for extensive stage small cell, they're getting screened, they're getting CAT scans frequently as monitoring for disease progression. And so I don't worry as much in that setting. In non-small cell lung cancer with the drugs I've mentioned, they also are still going to be getting CAT scans somewhat frequently. But we saw some data out of World Lung in the neoadjuvant setting that might become something to monitor for. We'll see how that story evolves.
What about the CNS activity with IDXD? We've been seeing more and more CNS activity with ADCs the more we look for it, particularly, again, breast cancer, TDXD, clearly it has some benefit. The ESMO meeting that just concluded had a paper looking at this. It looked like they saw some benefit. What was your take on that?
Yeah, and I think this is really encouraging. Now, across all of the, we're seeing a similar response rate across all of the deruxtecan studies. Now, we have intracranial data also from patritumab deruxtecan and datopotamab deruxtecan. You mentioned TDXD and now IDXD. The one thing, if you go back to that one other chart of, I think something to highlight from this. So some of these patients had prior radiation therapy, had radiation prior to their baseline. Now, that's really important to highlight because you can't really accurately determine whether there's a response in a lesion if it's been previously radiated. I suppose if there had been progression within that lesion and now you're seeing activity there, but then you could look at that. So the boxes represent those who had prior radiation. So some of those are mixed in here, but the circles are people that did not. So you do see clear indication of responses in brain mets that had not previously been treated. Now, we have seen that also from Dato-DXD and from patritumab deruxtecan. These, across the board, it looks like a response rate of probably about 30%. If you're looking at within each of those studies, the number of patients that did not have prior radiation and what the response rate is within those lesions, it was essentially 10 out of 30 in the patritumab deruxtecan study, 1 out of 3 in Dato-DXD from TROPION-Lung05. And here it was also about 30%, it looks like, in those that hadn't had prior radiation.
Chat room wants to know, do you need to look for the target or it's present in all patients?
So the target has not been an indicator of response. That's been true in multiple of the ADCs that we've seen with sastuzumab govitecan. For TROP2, the TROP2 levels hadn't mattered. For Dato-DXD, the TROP2 levels hadn't mattered. And we did just see at World Lung a new potential biomarker for TROP2 testing that might actually, that looks promising when looking at PFS from TROPION-Lung01. That's still very early. That came out late breaking. So we'll see where that story goes. But B7H3 expression at this point has not really been an indicator. Now, I don't know. The TROP2 test looked at surface level TROP2 as well as intracellular TROP2. And it was actually a higher ratio of intracellular TROP2 that seems to be the indicator for the biomarker for those that are going to respond. And I wonder if that is just an indicator of higher internalization of the receptor. And maybe something like that needs to be done with B7H3. I think there's still a lot of work to do on that.
So I know everybody who's watching this is thinking to themselves, well, theoretically, how do we sequence these two new agents? You have tarlatamab. Now you have a pretty exciting ADC that causes response rates over 50%, kind of making topotecan look, and or, you know, the other options, including LURB-B, look not as exciting. But here's a randomized study that's going to look at that. Where do you think we're going to land in the next couple of years in terms of sequencing with tarlatamab and IDXD?
You know, it's this is not something that the small cell oncology community has had to deal with. We've not had a ton of different options that have been encouraging. So it's exciting to have that. No, I think it gives us an opportunity to talk to each patient and treat each patient individually. There are some patients where they've had a long time of disease control with initial platinum-based treatment, and so other cytotoxics then are more likely to have a longer time of disease control. I still think lurbinectedin is a good option for that. Irinotecan is my preference to topotecan. Both of those, I think, are good. For IDXD to now be in the mix, paclitaxel is, of course, still an option as well. With a shorter time of chemotherapy-free interval, that's where I think those curves for tarlatamab are really encouraging to see that that's not limiting what we're seeing from durability of responses in that group. Now, there are some patients where you can coordinate the hospital admission, but in the years ahead, you know, for tarlatamab, we might transition to be able to give that as an outpatient as well. When that happens, that would kind of alter the field too. So, you know, each patient individually will be able to assess and what the treatment that seems like it'd be best for them.
So no big surprise that these agents are going to be looked at in the upfront setting. So IDXD plus atezolizumab with or without carbo. That's kind of interesting as a first-line study. Any thoughts about this?
It is. Now, I am skeptical of anything overcoming platinum etoposide. This has been our best cytotoxic by far, but it's the first treatment. But here's the thing. The deruxtecan payload is a topoisomerase inhibitor payload. So it's similar to irinotecan, which we know is an effective drug, but giving platinum irinotecan, although common in Japan, is in a U.S. population is not tolerated as well. And so that's not really part of our standard of care in the U.S. But if it's delivered with the antibody drug conjugate technology, then maybe it could be. So I do think there is a potential real place for that. I think it's an exciting trial.
So a couple other things, you know, when we were chatting before we got started, I asked you if there are any myths or misperceptions that you think may be out there about small cell. And I guess I could summarize what I heard as your response is maybe that people give up on patients too soon. They bring possibly, they don't realize it. Can you elaborate on your thoughts about that?
You know, I see patients sometimes where they've been told by their oncologist that essentially they need to go on hospice. And so they come in for some kind of last ditch effort and they'll say, I know there's not really anything, but I just had to know that I've looked. And you know, there's still standard of care options and the patient still has a good performance status. And so there are options. I think right now, what I would consider very reasonable, what my regimens that I'll use, certainly the platinum etoposide plus checkpoint inhibitor, I've mentioned lurbinectedin, tarlatamab, irinotecan. If they've come to me and they've gotten topotecan, then, you know, they've gotten that. So irinotecan or topotecan, paclitaxel, temozolomide. Now, temozolomide has good CNS penetration. So does irinotecan and topotecan. But if they've had radiation of the brain and they've had irinotecan or topotecan, and now they have intracranial progression that can't be treated with radiation, then temozolomide is an option. I have a patient right now who's about, he's now about 2.5 months in on treatment with temozolomide for intracranial disease that can't be radiated, and it's responding. So, you know, there, now each of these, you know, these aren't cures, obviously. And for the most part, these cytotoxics, when they work for months, not years. But, you know, you can get many months out of each of these different lines of therapy, and that can add up to a meaningful time. Of course, now we have tarlatamab, which can, and the T-cell engagers, where we can sometimes see years of therapy, years of benefit as well.
So I also wanted to ask you about this paper presented at ASCO, BEAT-SC, bringing in bevacizumab. We did a webinar where we talked about the wild bispecific Asian bispecific, what's his name, ivonescimab, that they presented a phase 3 trial at World Lung, an incredible presentation, phase 3, beating out pembrolizumab. And of course, everybody was saying, 0.51 beat, but then everybody was saying, well, suppose you just added Bev to PD-1, which of course has been done in various situations. So I don't know if they're going to have to go back. I know they're going to want to see North American data. I don't know if they're going to look compared to Bev. But meanwhile, this paper gets presented. I don't remember seeing much about Bev in small cell. And, you know, they added it to extensive stage standard therapy and looked like it kind of worked to me. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, now, first of all, I have to give them props just for the name. I love the name BeatSC. Yeah. I think as far as a trial name, that's great. Yeah, you know, hazard ratio of 0.7, but, you know, the overall survival curves actually looked reversed. It was the overall survival curves were a hazard ratio of 1.22, and that's probably why there wasn't as much. You know, you highlighted the ivonescimab for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, which looks to be Pembro. We don't yet have any overall survival data on this. I wonder, you know, if this hadn't had the overall survival as part of the presentation, maybe there would have been more of a buzz about it. With the incorporation of VEGF, we've seen this before where we see what looks like very good in progression-free survival, but doesn't translate to overall survival. Now, that being said, you know, the one other thing in non-small cell lung cancer is we have the Pragmatica trial, which is adding VEGF to Pembro in the second line setting. And that is based upon earlier data that showed no difference in PFS, but a beat in OS. So, you know, there's something to VEGF, and this is why we keep chasing it. But I don't think we yet really understand what.
I was so glad they picked John Haymock to discuss that. He's my go-to VEGF person in lung cancer, but I'm not sure he completely explained it as well. In any event, it's been really great talking about small cell. Maybe I could end another question from the chat room, get back to real life. Dr. Kumar in the chat room wants to know, what's the role of taxanes in small cell lung cancer?
Great. Actually, paclitaxel, I think, is a really good regimen. It's well tolerated. I dose that as the weekly dosing. So it's 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off. And I find that to generally be very well tolerated. I think the important thing when we're getting into those lines of therapy is we want something that's not going to add much toxicity. And so weekly dosing of paclitaxel is pretty well tolerated. So I think it's a good option.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jacob, for chatting with us today. And audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Jacob.
Thank you.